Welcome to Adult Siblings Versus, a podcast where a grown-ass brother and sister put aside their childhood rivalry in order to review nostalgic pieces of pop culture. I'm your co-host, Jason S. Leverett.
And I'm your other co-host, Ariel Leverett.
Well, Ariel, so I don't know when this episode's going up, but I can tell you that I'm very behind on uploading episodes, so this is a very late episode. Maybe there's been an episode before this, I'm not sure. But it's been very late. I do apologize. Also, depending on when this goes up, whatever I said we were going to do last time you heard an episode, we are not doing that now. We're pushing whatever that was to next week or whenever the next time we do it. So Ariel, can you tell everybody what we're doing today instead?
Yeah. So we are interrupting our regularly scheduled programming. We are probably in the midst of early 2000s Disney stuff, but I wanted to pause that for a second for a special episode. We are actually covering the 1993 Kenneth Branagh Shakespeare movie, Much Ado About Nothing. So you're like, oh, why? So this is a special episode that I wanted to do because this was a favorite childhood movie of a dear friend and friend of the podcast, Morgan. She's one of the few people who really very consistently like to contact us and give her two cents. Unfortunately, she has recently passed away. She passed away in August, and I wanted to do something special to just kind of celebrate her in summer of 2021. We actually were discussing about alternatives for the podcast while Jason was on paternity leave, and one thing we considered was the two of us doing an episode because she is my adopted twin sister. And she always said that if she could do an episode on our podcast, it would be for Much Ado. So I wanted to do this episode kind of in honor of her and to explore something that she watched constantly as a kid. She really loved this movie when she was growing up. So that's what this is for. Technically, I didn't watch this as a kid. I think it came up. I think I saw part of it once when I was little, when it was just on TV, and I'm like, watch this. I think the first time I actually watched it all the way through, I was probably 18, but young enough. It's been quite some time since I first watched it, so it'll still have a nostalgic factor, at least for me. So yeah, that's kind of where we are.
I'm not even sure if I knew this movie existed, because as I was getting ready to watch it, I was like, what's Denzel Washington doing here? So maybe I just didn't have any real idea about it.
Yeah, all you people sleeping on Denzel Washington and Shakespeare, thinking this whole Macbeth movie that he did is something new. He's been in these streets doing Shakespeare movies for a minute.
It would seem so. It would seem so. So we're going to get into it. But before we do, as always, a kind of quick reminder, if you would like to get a hold of us to discuss Shakespeare or, I guess, complain about us changing the schedule or being late, I don't like those messages, but I can't stop you because this is America and or whatever country you're in.
This is also because it's America. If anyone gives a shit for this episode, I will literally fight you. Name a place.
Yeah. We'll see if I cut that line out.
leave it in. I want them to know, and hopefully we have a legion of Morgan stans listening to this episode and hopefully celebrating her along with me. So
you can give us an email, shoot us an email at adultsiblingsversus@gmail.com. you can tweet at us at adultversus on Twitter, and we have a Facebook page that you can reach out to as well. All right, so let's go into it. So, Much Ado About Nothing is 1993 film adaptation of William Shakespeare's play of the same name. There's a couple of different adaptations of Much Ado About Nothing, including a much more recent one that has Nathan Fillion in it.
That was the one that was in recently by Joss Whedon, which I have seen and was very excited for and did not enjoy. So even with Nathan Fillion in, I did enjoy Nathan Fillion. But in general, I did not actually like that version.
Mm. This one, as you said, was directed by Kenneth Branagh, a guy who I am very hot and cold with.
Yeah, yeah. Doesn't Mom hate him?
Does she?
I could have sworn, like, I feel like I remember, like, watching Wild Wild West and her spitting venom about Kenneth Branagh. And I feel like by the time we got to the Harry Potter movies, and because he was in it, in the second movie, playing Gilderoy Lockhart, I feel like she had, like, the equivalent of, this fucking guy. Yeah. Feel like she does not like him.
Why would she have dislike for him? She doesn't really seem like someone who watches a ton of Shakespeare films.
I don't remember if it's related to that necessarily. I don't know, but I feel like she is fairly anti-Kenneth Branagh. Maybe she saw him in a movie and she just hated him in.
Maybe she dislikes him because of the relationship problems that he had. So I'm not maybe. Sure. I wasn't sure how much we were going to get into it.
But, I want to get into it at least a little bit.
But just like we can go into it a bit more later. But like his wife, Emma Thompson, at the time, is also in this movie. And then famously, they stopped being married because of bad decisions on his part, we'll say. And we can get more into it later. Maybe Mom knew about that and has been an Emma Thompson stan this whole time. We just didn't know. And she's just like, oh, man, I hate this guy. He broke her heart. He broke her heart.
Yeah, she's like secretly wearing T-shirts that say hashtag not my Emma. Mm. I don't know.
I'm not sure what that means in context there. Okay. But if you don't know Kevin Branagh is probably his like redneck cousin or something. Kenneth Branagh is he's a director and actor. He's done a lot of films, but
you might know him best for his masterwork of Thor.
Yeah, I was gonna say he's most famous probably in like generally speaking for Shakespeare adaptations, but he is probably his biggest. Well, I guess not anymore. I guess actually he's done a lot of weird things. So he did Thor for some reason. Actually, you know what? I initially thought that was a good idea because Thor in the comic book steals a lot of Shakespeare-isms.
Sure.
So like he thought, oh yeah, get the Shakespeare guy to do it, and it wasn't wonderful. And he hated it. Like he's not coming back. But he also did the adaptations of the Agatha Christie novels, Murder on the Orient Express, and then more recently Death on the Nile. And rather unfortunately, he also did the recent adaptation of the Artemis Fowl movies, which everyone seemed to despise. So.
Of those three movies, or, you know, groups of movies, I only saw Murder on the Orient Express, which I think I saw it in movie theaters. I thought it was fine. I don't think he's a good Poirot. I didn't particularly like him in that role, but, you know, he's the director and he puts himself in. Actually, he reminds me of a lot of, like, less than great, like, theater guys. But I'll get into that later.
Yeah, I've got some stuff to say about Kenneth Branagh as an actor that will probably be best saved for when we get into the movie itself. Yeah. But I will also give credit where credit is due. He also directed Belfast, which was, you know, it received like 7 Academy Award nominations in the last Academy Awards, the 94th. So that would be like 2001. And he won for Best Original Screenplay, and he wrote the film, so he does have an Oscar, at least one Oscar.
I do want to see that. It is streaming right now, and it is on my radar, but we'll see if I get around to it.
Yeah, so, you know, But you know what I didn't like? I didn't like his Hamlet. So I don't know.
I have never seen his Hamlet. I did watch his Henry V. God, he takes himself so dang serious.
He does. He does. Why was he directing Thor? Like,
yeah, it's ridiculous. I did see his As You Like It. I don't remember a lot about it. I might rewatch it, but all I can remember is just like me going, "Ah, from Melina, I love you and everything." I remember nothing else about that film.
The only thing I can say about As You Like It is that I constantly get As You Like It and What to Do About Nothing's titles mixed up.
Sure.
Like at some point, and I'd watched the movie, but at some point I was typing up in Google trying to like get some stuff for my notes. I kept typing in As You Like It. Like, why can't I find this movie?
It's like, when does Hero dress up like a boy? Like,
none of these things have Denzel Washington in it. What's going on? Oh, right. It's, I had to look up your text. I literally had to look up your text asking to do this to just make sure I knew which movie we were doing. And again, had already watched it. Had watched it like 2 weeks ago at this point.
Well, I mean, it's not like, you know, anything about the titles give anything away about what the play is about. Like, thank goodness Twelfth Night is Twelfth Night or What You Will. If it was just What You Will, it would be in the same category as, like, yeah. I don't know, something, something, we're doing stuff, the play.
Yeah. Anyway, so this movie was made for $11 million, which, I mean, for 1993, it's probably not nothing. But obviously a smaller budget film. If that was made today, that'd be it'd be a particularly cheap indie film somehow. it ended up grossing $43 million. So on an $11 million budget, that's pretty good for a film I'm not a big Shakespeare person the way you are, so I can't say that they completely lift the script from the play, but it seems like they do, and that's kind of a hard sell for the average American. So the fact that it made a decent chunk of money, it's pretty good. They should have made a sequel, Much to Do About Nothing.
Whoo, amazing. That's going to be a musical.
That's going to be a musical.
But yeah, it is a pretty traditional adaptation. Very, you know, he's really holding on to like the traditional script. I mean, making like cuts like one does, because heaven forbid you make this freaking thing 3 hours. But yeah, it's pretty close.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't have a whole lot of information regarding the background of the production of this. In fact, I don't really have much of anything other than this is just, I mean, you can kind of put two and two together. You know, Kenneth Branagh is not a person with a small ego. And as you alluded to, he does like to cast himself in leads, or at least the best role, a lot of the time. And his wife is playing opposite him. So this, I mean, like, I don't know if he was quite powerful enough in Hollywood to call this a vanity project, but I feel like it's as close as you can get when you're at the level that he was in Hollywood in 92, 93. Just like, I want to do Shakespeare. I want to make a movie based on Shakespeare, and I want to star it and make out with my wife while I do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure my wife's nipples are everywhere.
The distributor was just the Samuel Godwin Company. This is the only point, the only thing I really have here. It's just interesting trivia. So they paid $10 million for the push for Oscar consideration for this film. So they paid $10 million for the campaign to get the Academy to nominate this movie. And apparently they tried a lot of different avenues. $10 million, not a single nomination. Yeah, $10 million, only $1 million less than the budget. So this movie costs $11 million, $10 million for the push. And if they were going to spend that much money for just the Oscar campaign, they probably did a pretty decent amount of advertising for this movie as well, especially with like Denzel Washington, he was on a pretty big high in his career at this time, early 90s.
Oh, yeah, total hot streak.
Yeah, so like, you know, get Denzel Washington, in a Shakespeare film that you're doing as a prestige film that you're going to try to get Oscar noms for, yeah, I imagine that the marketing was budget was probably pretty high too. So if you add all that stuff together, maybe the gross wasn't that good after all. All right, so that's really all I have. So we can go right into it. But bad news. So I actually did watch the Joss Whedon version instead of this. And it's, you know, basically the same plot, but unfortunately it left me with me being on a moral high horse for being a feminist while also treating women really badly. So I'm not sure I'm in the best mindset to talk about the film. So how about you go ahead and tell us what happened?
Absolutely. I feel like anytime you're watching a modern, like contemporary, like I'm going to do Shakespeare and I'm also going to put it in black and white, I always immediately go, okay, here we go.
I mean, and, yeah, this is definitely pretentious.
Yeah, and Joss Whedon's Much Ado does do that.
Doesn't Macbeth do that too?
It does. Oh my God. Everyone is so into doing Macbeth movies right now, and they're so contemplative and so outrageously heavy. Stop cutting out the door guard scene when he's making jokes about pissing and being drunk. You need to have comedic breaks. Anyway, that's not the point.
Actually, I'm sorry, but this just reminds me of my favorite quote that you've ever said to me in our entire lives.
Oh, cool. What?
Because I asked you, because you'd been in theater for some years at this point, and I had been theater adjacent for a while, so I had asked you about Macbeth and like, do you call it Macbeth or do you call it the cursed play, or are you superstitious about saying the name? And your response was, I just say the name. I believe in Jesus.
Oh, yes. It's one of my favorite jokes. I do think it's stupid to not say Macbeth. Let the ghosts come if they're going to come. Okay. So, Much Ado. So, as we mentioned before, this adaptation of the play is pretty traditional. It takes place in Messina, Italy, in the, you know, presumably like late 1500s or something. Like I'm assuming they're trying to make it kind of like at least maybe a little bit later than Shakespeare's time, but you know. So basically what has happened in the town of Messina, many of the men of the town have been gone for war, and news has come that Don Pedro and the other men from the area are finally coming home. It's very exciting. The beginning of the story is taking place at like kind of the households, the estate of Leonato. He has a daughter, Hero, and a niece, Beatrice. Beatrice is kind of our main female character. She has this ongoing feud with our main guy character, Benedict. And so when they find out, like, the men are coming back, the first thing she does is start, like, talking shit about Benedict. Another one of the soldiers coming home is Claudio, who has a crush on Hero, and Hero has a crush on Claudio. They're the two ingenues of the show, and they're, you know, therefore they're very annoying, because ingenues are the worst. So the way the story goes, the men come home and hang out at Leonato's. Don Pedro also has this estranged brother, Don John, who is just all about just stirring shit because he's sad all the time and he's just in a bad mood. And he's just like, I just want to stir shit. And he does. Claudio proposes to Hero, or at least Don Pedro kind of like wins her for him and breaks off his engagement with Hero, and everything's very exciting. Benedict and Beatrice are still going around just like jabbing at each other. They used to date at some point, but now they're all like, yeah, that person's a dick. As everyone's getting ready for Hero and Claudio's nuptials, Don John is like, I'm ready to stir some more shit. And he tells Claudio, hey, the girl you like, I mean, you want to marry her? Because like, she's definitely cheating on you. And like, you might not believe me, but I can show you. And he's basically come up with this plan to make it look like someone is, quote unquote, talking to her out a window. But like, basically, it's always set up that like she's like fucking someone. And you can't see her face, but they always have it that the person who's like sleeping with her is like saying Hero. It's actually the character Margaret, who's just, you know, getting her socks off and just living her fullest life. Claudio is furious and publicly shames her at the wedding, breaks it off. Leonato's is basically about to kill poor Hero, and there's a lot of trouble that happens there. Beatrice and Benedict basically get tricked into thinking that the other one has been saying that they love them. It's very cute to Caesar's like, I heard that she said this and I heard she says that, and they eavesdrop. It is cute. They start to fall in love. The friar who convinces Hero to not convinces Leonardo not to kill his freaking daughter. It's like, why don't you just like lie and say that Hero is dead, get Claudio to feel bad about it, and the truth will be revealed. And that's pretty much what happens. They basically go, well, you killed my daughter, but you can marry her twin cousin to make up for it. And when Claudio agrees to that, after realizing that all of that stuff was a lie, at the wedding, it turns out, oh, Hero's alive. Hooray, let's get married. And Benedict and Beatrice are like, you know what? I do soups love you. Let's get married too. The end. Oh, and Don John's just in the back, like kind of being like, burr. He tries to run away, but he gets caught. So, burr. That's basically the movie.
So here's the thing about this film, and it's going to be a little difficult for me to talk about it, but there's two ways to look at this film. Coming from a reviewing it as like from a Shakespearean perspective, like someone who is really knowledgeable and understanding of Shakespeare's works, and looking at it from a movie perspective, someone who may not be that familiar with Shakespeare's work, just kind of looking at it as a movie. Now, if you are just looking at this as a movie, this movie could be impenetrable for you.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is actually one of the breezier Shakespeare stories that I've seen. So it's not, I don't think it's too hard to follow, but you know, like, not everybody wants to go to see a film to not only understand like every three words.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand someone not liking this movie very much. I, as somebody who had to look up the plot beforehand just in case.
Sure.
I thought this movie was fine. I thought it was a pretty decent film, all things considered, that was delightfully funny at times.
Yeah, I think as far as, like, you know, Shakespeare stuff goes, the nice thing about Much Ado is that, like, the shit-talking that Beatrice and Benedict do, I think, are more understandable than other kinds of Shakespeare. Like, I think their jabs, like, you can get their jabs, and I think that makes it more fun.
It helps that, I mean, this is almost certainly by design on Branagh's part, but like, you know, this is like that stuff between them is probably the best part of the film. And well, first of all, we can get into characters later, but just gonna throw it out there, like, Emma Thompson is perfect for a role like this.
Oh yeah,
like the kind of like shit talking, I don't care about what no man says, I'm powerful in my own right for whatever reason, whether I be rich or just connected or just don't give a fuck. Like, that is like Emma Thompson's brand.
I just love her and everything.
Yeah, I can't think of anything offhand that I thought she was not super good in. I can think of, like, I don't know, was Men in Black 3 good? I can't remember.
I think there are movies that are not good around her, but yeah, I can't think of it. Yeah, I can't think of anything that like I have seen her do that I'm like, I do not like you in this.
Yeah, that was going to be the point I was going to make.
Oh, like, gotcha. Like, I do not remember anything about Men in Black 3 beyond her being there and being like, oh, and Jemaine Clement being in there and with his outrageous makeup and being going, ah, it's Jemaine Clement, wee. But anything else of that?
I didn't realize it was him until the credits.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I doubt I'll watch that movie again. But there is a chance.
No, I mean, like,
for that.
I might rewatch some of the Men in Black movies, including 3. This is not the Men in Black podcast, although I want it to be.
Oh, you know, we probably will have to do that at some point.
Well, the first one for sure.
Yeah. Because we did watch it. Anyway, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that's like the stuff between, you know, Beatrice and Benedict, easily the best part of the film. Everything and probably the play. You know, everything else is like fine until it becomes really fucked up.
Yeah, yeah.
So first of all, what the hell is Don John's problem?
So some of his like conversations with his kind of sidekick Conrad, that gets condensed quite a bit in this, probably understandably so, because there's kind of not a big point in having Keanu Reeves do like a bunch of monologues and stuff, because like he himself is not that comfortable in the language, so like Keanu Reeves doing a bunch of like monologues is just gonna waste our time. But he, like, part of it is, I mean, first of all, like, Don John himself is just like this brooding person. Like, he's just kind of like, his personality itself is just seems to be that he's kind of a dick, and he had been like in bad graces with his brother Don Pedro, who was essentially like basically a prince kind of character. He had been in bad, I can't remember, they might be like half brothers or something.
They're half brothers.
Yeah. So like he had been in the out, like on the outs with Don Pedro, and like finally they had kind of like mended fences a little bit, but he's kind of on a short leash with Don Pedro, and he's like really, really like mad about it. It's like, it's weird, kind of like, how dare you be mad that I'm such an asshole and then try to like contain me? Let me just be an asshole. And so, yeah, like, he's, yeah.
I feel like the answer to my question then is he's an asshole, and that's what his problem is. Like that's kind of like the first thing that I kind of note here, is that Don John doesn't seem to have a ton of motivation for trying to ruin everybody's lives here, other than he's just like, oh, what fun it would be to be a dick.
Yeah, just because you're kind of, what, not in the shining light as much as your brother, and he's not giving you the things you want when you've kind of proven that you don't really deserve those things. Like, it's, yeah, it's,
yeah,
it's,
then he should ruin Don Pedro's, like, romance. Like, why is he messing with Claudio?
Which, Don Pedro, not doing great.
No. Like, bad.
He was supposed, because, like, he was supposed to be engaged to Hiro, but, like, saying that, I mean, he's very gracious, saying that Claudio is in love with her and that she clearly wants him. He's like, it's fine. I'll break it. You know, it's cool. You crazy cats get together. And then like later on, he's talking to Beatrice and she's all like, I don't want no man, until he's like super great. Don Pedro's like, well, like, you know, what about me? Hey, yeah, I'm here. And she shoots him the fuck down. And it's like, Don Pedro, not doing great.
No,
in the love realm, like
it's one of the rare Shakespeare comedies where the older rich guy doesn't get married.
Yeah, he doesn't even. I mean, had this been Measure for Measure, he would have just taken one of the women and just like, you're welcome, I'm marrying you.
Yeah. But yeah, so like the whole plot of this film boils down to Don John wants to ruin Claudio's life for no good reason other than he has a grudge against his brother, and his brother is friends with Claudio. So I guess it's like, if I hurt you, I hurt my brother, and that's what I love the most. And I watch as I kick this dog and drink this baby blood. Like I don't know. Like you know, some Shakespeare villains can be kind of nuanced, and some of them are just cartoonishly, pointlessly evil, and I think Don John is in the latter category. But kind of going back to what I was saying before, when things really just go to shit, it's really when Don John's plan turns into setting up Hiro to look like she has been sleeping around, and just how much and how badly Claudio and Don Pedro just turn on her. It is so gross.
God, so gross. I hate Claudio. I hate him so much. This is one of those examples where it's just like, there are times, like I do a fair amount of Shakespeare, and there are times where it's just like, I don't know if I want to do this. Like, I don't like the message this sends. Like, he shouldn't, like, Claudio does not deserve Hero. And it sucks that, you know, this is of a time where him just being like, whoops, sorry about all this stuff, let's still get married. And she's like, still like, oh, hooray. Like, you publicly shamed me. And even when you initially thought I was dead, you were still pretty okay with it. Like,
yeah. Yeah, he didn't feel bad about her dying until he found out that she was slandered.
When Leonardo and Antonio go to confront Pedro and Claudio, and Leonardo's like, hey, dick, my daughter is dead, and it's your fault. And they're just still like, huh, sorry about you, bro.
Yeah, sorry your daughter was a whore who killed herself, I guess.
Yeah, like, holy shit, he's the worst. And in there's a scene when the soldiers first come back to town, and it's like this masquerade in town square or whatever. And that's the first time Don John starts to stir the pot. It's already been established, like, Pedro already says to Claudio, I'm gonna win Hero for you. He's already said this. He's already like, I'm gonna break my marriage. I'm gonna like woo her for you. And knowing this, Claudio sees like Don Pedro, essentially, like, he's like on one knee and he's like talking to her, and he's already like, what is this motherfucker doing? What is, like, he literally just told you what he was doing. And then Don John comes up, is like, hey, I know that I'm a total shifty character who you've been like fighting beside for who knows how long, and you definitely know the kind of person I am, but you know what, I'm pretty sure Don Pedro is like definitely taking Hero for yourself. And he's like, well, sounds right to me. I'm pissed. And the idea that after that, and like, and then finding out that, like, oh, well, that wasn't true. He was doing what, like, Don Pedro was doing what he said he was going to do, wooing on Claudio's behalf. Don John was lying. Even though that moment happened, the idea that Don John can show up later and then essentially do the same thing again, and he's like, you know what? Fool me twice. Gonna believe you. And like, Claudio is awful. He is such a dumbass.
Secret epilogue to this play and movie that didn't make it to print. Claudio goes to visit Don John in jail to mock him. And then Don John's like, hey, you know, I heard that it was actually Benedict who was behind all of this, and he's actually sleeping with Hero right now. And Claudio's immediately like, no, and kills everyone else in the play.
No, yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure like he could just keep doing this and just keep naming people that like Hero's sleeping with, and then they just like, keep doing this again and again.
Hey, Don John, I just killed Benedict, and Beatrice says that wasn't true what you just said. Well, that's because Beatrice is behind it. What? No!
It's like,
Beatrice has been sleeping with Hero. They're cousins.
Cousin
no!
love, my man. Yeah, yeah.
Cousin lesbian love. Yeah, that's just, you know, that's just, you know, you should go kill them. You're right, Don John. Here I go. Yeah, Claudio would believe all that. I just imagine. Oh my God. Man, someone should make a sequel to this where it's just that.
Just again and again.
Just again and again.
And like, it is excruciating how quick Leonardo was like, I am going to murder you, child, for that. Like, yeah. doesn't take a moment to find out what's real and true. You know her. Like, the idea that, like, without a breath, the first thing you hear is like, well, someone said that you're sleeping around. I will kill you. Like, you don't even, God. Don't even inquire in any ounce of a way. Like, maybe angrily inquire. You can be pissed off about the situation, but don't make your first gut action to be the process of trying to kill your child. Like, that's, yeah. Good Lord. Everyone sucks.
So, like, just so we understand, had Hero met a much better guy than Claudio in this and decided, you know what, I'm attracted to you, you're attracted to me, we're adults, let's just come back to my room. Then her, and if she had actually done that in a perfectly, you know, consensual way, her father would have murdered her. Let's just keep that in mind.
Well, apparently, if they had been betrothed, he would have been okay with it, because that's the conversation when Claudio is publicly shaming, and he's like, hey, guy, if you guys got down to some business at, you know, being betrothed, she's your wife, it's fine. And he's like, oh no, all I've done with her is just given chaste looks from across the room, it's not me. Like, so, like, he, in theory, I mean, assuming whatever shenanigans happened between them, like, post masquerade party, he would have been fine with it, but maybe he's just saying that to, like, defuse the situation. I don't know. But yeah, it's it just sucks. Like, that's what I love Beatrice's monologue, her conversation with Benedict after this horrible turn of events at the wedding that gets canceled, about the outrageous bullshittery of it all. And Emma Thompson does a great job of this scene, but I always love the, you know, oh, if I were a man, I'd eat his heart in the marketplace. Like, yeah. I love that line so much, because it's just like, it's so ridiculous, because, like, the whole monologue is just like, so all a guy has to do is say any lie and swear it, and it's fine. And everyone just believes it without anything. And women have absolutely no protection against such horrible things. Oh, if I could be a man. Like, it's so good. And at least Shakespeare acknowledges the bullshittery of this, but, like,
I mean, he kind of does. I mean, he acknowledges it, but I don't know if he's, like, if the play is necessarily, you know, saying it's a problem.
Because, oh, yeah, like, 100%. That's why it's just, like, yeah. It's a very frustrating play. It is, like, I've never done this play, but it's along with, like, when I did Two Gentlemen of Verona,
my least favorite Shakespeare play.
So fucking problematic. But it's like one of those things, just like, God, I don't like the message of this in the end.
At least this one, female characters still have some lines at the end of it, as opposed to Two Gentlemen of Verona, when all of them just kind of stop talking for a while.
Yeah.
And then the play ends. But okay, so, like, it's a complicated play as far as my feelings go, because, like, I think that, like, I think Beatrice is, like, a really interesting character. I don't know if I love that Benedict agreed to murder his best friend so quickly. I kind of wish it was more like beat his ass.
Yeah, it seems like, I think he's stalling, because, like, he doesn't go to immediately fight him. He's clearly like, oh, I, like, super don't want to kill him. He's my friend. I think he's a good guy. But I also want to get at that lady, you know?
Yeah.
And so, like, I think...
And he seems to genuinely believe that...
That he's done something
Hero,
wrong.
The Hero is innocent and everyone else is being stupid.
Yeah, I think the fact that he just challenges him... Because, like, later on... when he talks about, like, going to see Claudio, and he's like, you know, just gave him some rough words. And she's like, uh-uh, bitch, it needs to be a murder, because he's the worst. He's still like, okay, I set out the challenge, and either he comes to meet me, or or he's gonna be labeled as a coward. So it seems like he's not, you know, he's kind of hoping things will not go that far, but he's also trying to make sure that he can still get at that ass. So
yeah, well, I mean, like, he put himself in a situation where he would have to kill Claudio if Claudio accepts the challenge, though. So, like, he's still, you know, risking it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you get for telling a girl that you'll do anything for her and that she should just name it. She'll always ask you to kill someone.
Man, what a crazy, like, change in, like, relationship between the two of them.
Yeah.
I think we can assume that they both were always into each other.
Oh, they dated before.
Yeah, right, yeah. So they are still into each other, and they're just waiting for one to admit it to the other that they're so into them. And so when they get tricked into thinking that the other one has, then they just have a complete 180 instead of, like, bickering. There's Benedict is like, now I will murder men for you. Okay. But yeah, you know, like, it comes down to it. This is not the best comedy of Shakespeare that I've seen. To me, that's Twelfth Night. Twelfth Night is, I believe, my favorite Shakespeare play, in fact.
Yeah, I think, like, Beatrice is a character that I would very much love to play one day. Like, every once in a while, I get an audition, and I get to read for Beatrice, and I'm like, someone pull the trigger. Let me play Beatrice. But I think as far as, like, what Shakespeare comedy I am most willing to, like, watch again and again, yeah, I would say it's probably Twelfth Night.
Interesting. It looks like Beatrice and Hero both have their own separate Wikipedia pages. Claudio does not.
Yeah.
Neither does Benedict. I'm wondering why that is.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because Hero doesn't do shit.
Yeah.
Except get talked about. Like, that's like she's... poor Kate Beckinsale. Well, I'll get into that later, I guess.
Oh, man. It's so funny. I didn't even, like, recognize her. I would have totally forgotten that she was in this. But, like...
Fresh-faced Kate Beckinsale.
Yeah, little baby. Baby Beckinsale.
She's in college. She's literally taking a break from college to film this movie.
So great. Yeah. The ingenues are the worst. They're so boring. It makes me think of, like, classic Commedia dell'arte stuff, where you have the ingenues, the young lovers, and they're just there being cute. But, like, the people that you're really invested in are the clowns. You want, like, Arlecchino or oh, gosh. I'm, like, forgetting, like, the name of, like, kind of the young, like, woman equivalent of that. If you, like, look at, like, Goldoni stuff and you have, like, these more servant characters who are usually older than the ingenues and definitely, like, more plucky. And because they're kind of lower class, they're, like, just quicker on their feet and blah, blah, blah. And they're the more interesting characters. I feel like this has that element. And I feel like your personality will probably dictate whether you would want to be a Hero or a Beatrice.
I don't have much more to say, but there's something that I've been meaning to say. In that every time you've mentioned Leonardo's name, in my head I keep thinking... Leonardo leads, Don Pedro does machines.
I'm sorry that's been rushing into your head. Oh, also, before, because I feel like we're going to be getting into characters pretty soon, or at least, like, talking about the actors a little bit more. Before we get into that, as far as the aesthetic of this movie goes, I think it's a very, like, soothing aesthetic. Like, I think if you're the kind of person who, like, really, like, likes that pastoral kind of period piece, like, it's fantasiful. Like, I could see, like, very much enjoying the look of it. I kind of hate the opening sequence when everyone's like, woohoo, and, like, getting ready. Because, like, the men are back in town and we're getting ready for the party and everyone's taking baths and blah, blah, blah. It was just like, oh, my God. So many hairy asses and back of balls, and I was just like, this is a nightmare and so unnecessary. And I feel like they went out of their way to give all these women tops with, like, see-through linen, and so there was so much nipple under sheer fabric happening so unnecessarily, and it just was like, I just thought it was weird.
As for me, you know, I watch Shakespeare for the full Monty, and I'm only getting, like, a little bit of the balls? No, unacceptable. Come on, Brenna. Come on.
Go for it. See?
How about you have some balls and show some of them dicks?
Yeah. The whole sequence where you were just happily, like, trouncing through the fountain, that could have been totally naked. You could have had a naked romp through the fountain. Because you're happy you're in love.
Yeah, like, and all those soldiers were happy that they're in love, even though none of them had names or personalities, and we never see them again.
Oh boy.
All right, let's talk about characters. There's a lot of characters in here. I'm not sure how much sense it makes to get into every single person, but let's definitely talk about the leads first and foremost. So Kenneth Branagh plays Benedict. Of course he does. Of course he casts himself in the best male role in the film. I think it's unfair to call Branagh like the Shakespeare guy in Hollywood. And there's literally actors with like decades more experience with Shakespeare. So you could probably say that about like Ian McKellen, I think of as the Shakespeare guy in Hollywood. Even Patrick Stewart, yeah, I think of as the.
I have watched like old videos of Ian McKellen discussing Shakespeare and technique and all these things, and it's so amazing. And it's just like, yeah, when you have the experience of that kind of stuff, I don't think you could ever call Branagh the Shakespeare guy.
Yeah. However, I do think it's fair to say Branagh is the Shakespeare guy when it comes to turning Shakespeare plays into film, because he's done that a lot. And he clearly has a lot of experience with Shakespeare, a lot of love with Shakespeare. And I think it comes through in his performance here. Like, he's good. Like, he's very good at reading the lines. He's very expressive. He's a little... But he's a little kind of like up and down in terms of like, you know, he's going from 0 to 60 in terms of like being kind of passive to being super, super giddy. And that's a little cheesy sometimes. But like, I think he does basically a good job here. But I will say that this still feels like a vanity role for him, in that like, I want to give myself the guy with the best lines, who's the only male, not the only male, but like he's basically the only lead male who isn't a jerk. And I get to flirt with my wife over and over again.
Yeah.
It's great.
Well, you know, who knows who else in that cast he ended up sleeping with while flirting with his wife. But we won't get into that.
Oh, God. Oh, God. Becca. Kate, how are you doing?
Yeah. I'm so worried for her. Like, Kenneth Branagh has the vibe of problematic theater dudes that happen sometimes. I feel like nowadays we call it out more, but definitely in the past, going strong without anyone questioning it, that dude who thinks that they're such a genius and then everyone around him is indulging this, directing all the shit, casting himself, making a weird like monarchy with whoever, like his wife, blah blah blah, and also probably sleeping with everyone. And it's just, ugh. But like, as far as his Benedict goes, I think he does a good job. Like, I think he has fun with it. I think because he's directing it, I feel like it does a disservice, because I feel like he leans into his own, besides like the Dogberry stuff that is like inherently like that's full of gags, but I think he like focuses on his own comedic moments, and he like lets those shine a little bit more when other characters have those moments. Like, Beatrice is way funnier than they're letting her be in this movie, and I do think it's probably because of him. And even with that, like, I think there's more to be done with the language. Like, for me, my favorite Benedict is probably David Tennant. At this point, was it like 10 years ago, maybe less than that, I can't remember. But he did a production of Much Ado with Catherine Tate as Beatrice. And this was a play.
Just linked forever, those two, huh?
Yeah, well, I think that was probably part of the pull. Like, you know, I was like, oh my God, the Doctor and Donna, they're doing some Shakespeare. And it was
actually, hold on, back up. I should have like said, wow, Catherine Tate doing Shakespeare, huh? Man, what a career.
Yeah, here's the thing. I enjoyed her in it. I don't think she's my favorite Beatrice, but she holds her own and she does fun stuff in it. But
she does so much different stuff. Like, she's like, for someone who started out in comedy, she just does everything.
Yeah, people be sleeping on Catherine Tate. I do think so. But yeah, David Tennant, I think, has like does the best line reads that I've seen of a lot of Benedict's lines, and like just really making things more playful. I think when it comes, and like once again, this was a stage production that was filmed. I think a lot of times in films, people just like do not lean into the just the playful, irreverent shit that Shakespeare is. Like it could be like a comedy, but they don't have as much fun as like the lines actually entail. And I don't know why that always is with Shakespeare. And Shakespeare in movies in particular, I don't know why no one ever really like goes as far as like the language actually lends itself to be like a lot more fun than people tend to do it. It's like, you know, the percentage of dick jokes in Shakespeare plays, and it's like when you have one in a movie, like no one ever does the dick jokes.
It's really kind of funny. Just like, it's not even, this isn't just limited to movies, but just like the way that we as a society engage with Shakespeare is so different than the people who would have been seeing these plays when they were originally performed.
Yeah.
Like, I think people don't really understand just how much of a ruckus and evening out going to the Globe Theater was. Like, you're going to go out, you're going to get drunk, you're going to throw things at stage while you see a bunch of guys saying ridiculous languages, not actually indicative of what they're talk like at the time, and a lot of dudes in drag. Like, that is a night out at Shakespeare, and that is just not how we consume Shakespeare, even if we're going to see a play. It's a very formal, very serious affair. Even with comedies, like, you're not going to have like the audience being like hooting and hollering the way that you might have back in the day.
Yeah, I have to say, hats off to theaters that do play around with that. Usually they're smaller theaters, but like, I think of, say, you know, the Shakespeare company I used to work for in Michigan, Pigeon Creek, they used to, maybe they still do sometimes, I don't know, but like sometimes they would do a comedy and have a night where it was like attached to a drinking game. And so it's just like, you know, take a drink every time blah, 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 like this thing happens, every time you see a new fancy hat, and like, you know, and performed it at a place that had a bar. Or I've like, I remember when I was in Louisville, and the interns at Actors Theater did a production of Midsummer at a bar, and everybody got super drunk, and it was such a fun time, and it was raucous. And I think it's kind of, I think it's definitely fun when theater does do that, because like, yeah, it's where kind of Shakespeare lives. And like when I've done unrehearsed Shakespeare, I think a lot of times it lends itself to that, because the actors themselves, it's because they're not rehearsing it, they have to think on their toes, they have to go straight for the easiest joke, which is usually the dirtiest joke. And most of the time that I see in rehearsed Shakespeare, it is in the like in the realm of like a small venue, like a bar or something like that. And so it lends itself to being very raucous and fun, and everything's really fevered. And I think that's why, and I think because it's unrehearsed, in the style of it is most similar to how it would have been performed at the time. And that way is crazy. And it's very, very fun. But you don't see that in most Shakespeare. Definitely don't see that in big theaters. Like, Shakespeare companies and Shakespeare festivals definitely ain't doing it. And you're not seeing that kind of energy in films.
Yeah. It's just, you know, the way that Shakespeare would have, or if you listen to some people, the team of people who claim to be Shakespeare. You heard that theory?
Yes, yeah, I have heard that theory.
You know, the idea, like the type of audience and the type of performance that he was envisioning these to be are just so different than what like our society kind of consumes. It's just, it's almost like to the play's detriment in a lot of cases. So, but I think the, you know, make a long story short here, Kevin Branagh is okay in this role.
Yeah. Oh yes, long story short, I do kind of find it funny, the whole thing about like the team of people who wrote Shakespeare's plays. It's like, one, I don't think Shakespeare is as amazing as would warrant the idea of a bunch of people writing his plays. And also it makes you think, it's like, wow, in like 300 years, are people going to be like, yes, the team of people, wink, wink, who wrote Discworld, the Discworld series, like that kind of thing. It's like, can a person like be prolific?
The team of people who wrote the Tyler Perry movies.
Impossible. Not one man could have made so many masterful movies and TV series.
Let's talk about Emma Thompson briefly. You already kind of talked about Beatrice enough that I don't know there's much more to say. Maybe you have a little more to say, but I just want to again mention that Emma Thompson's extremely good in this film. She is the best performance in this film, mm-hmm. in my opinion. Her as Beatrice is so good that hearing that apparently they cut out a lot of her lines, a lot of her funny lines, deeply depresses me.
Yeah.
Because, like, I watched this film going, like, wow, Beatrice is the best character in here. And here you're coming along going, like, oh, yeah, she had, like, a lot more cool lines that they just didn't include. And now I'm just like, fuck this movie.
I mean, this is a person who needs to not be caged. You gotta let her fly.
Yeah, she's a peacock. You gotta
let her fly. She's a peacock. You gotta let her fly. And, like, but, like, God, it's, like, it's all for the best. Like, it's all for the best that they did not stay together, because she doesn't need him. She didn't need him. Fuck him. And I wish we could have seen more of whatever she brought to the table, because I bet that, like I mentioned before, about how it really felt like he was reserving more of that wit and funny energy for himself. I bet the times that Emma Thompson brought that to the table, he was like, you know, I don't think we need this. I think we could just cut it. I don't think it's very important. Like, I could see that happening. But yeah, Emma Thompson, always great. She's great in this. Bless her.
So we got Robert Sean Leonard as Claudio. And I gotta tell you, he's fine. Like, Claudio is such a shit character, though, that it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah. So this is that classic ingenue character where, like, you really don't need to have a super dynamic person playing it, because the character itself is not super dynamic. Like, this is, yeah, it's like you're young and handsome, so this is, what a fun time. Woo.
Yeah,
I wonder what would have happened. Well, I don't know. I'm like, with Keanu Reeves, if it would have been gone better for him had he been Claudio as opposed to Don John, but I don't know.
Well, we'll get to him in a bit, yeah. But I do want to just point out that Robert Sean Leonard, I recognized him, but I didn't remember from what.
I had that moment too, yeah.
And I have since realized that he was on House. He was like House's best friend, which is where I immediately recognized him. But then I found out later that I actually recognize him from a really weird source. One of my big guilty pleasure movies from when I was a kid that I used to, you know, anytime I saw that it was on, like, on TV Guide, that it was playing on, like, HBO or whatever, I'd always sneak downstairs to watch it, like, at 4 a.m. That is 1987's My Best Friend is a Vampire, huh. which was a 80s teen vampire comedy. That he was in. It's not a good movie. But it's a movie that I watched a bunch, and it was just like super into. He was like he was a teenage act, like, character in this. So he was a high schooler in this. Not to be confused with Once Bitten, which stars a fresh faced Jim Carrey playing another teenager who is having vampire shenanigans. That movie is not as good as My Best Friend is a Vampire, so says 10-year-old Jason's memory.
Oh, man, we'll have to put this on the list, because I don't remember that at all.
No, I don't know how much you would have watched it, because I tended to watch a lot of my vampire movies, like, on my own. Like, just kind of watch it in the dead of night when everyone else is asleep.
Oh, that's very funny.
I just sneak downstairs. Also, same thing with The Craft, which I also watched a bunch secretly and on my own in the middle of the night.
I did watch The Craft a lot. But then again, I also had friends who were Wiccan.
Yeah, but, like, you know, as far as, you know, as him here, there's just not a lot to talk about. Like, he's fine. I do want to talk about Kate Beckinsale a little bit, though, because she's in the exact same position, except worse, because Hero really just does dick all in this film. But I do want to point out that, actually, Hero doesn't do dick all. That's the point. So, like, she, like, that was slander on my part, and I apologize. Beatrice, please don't have your boy kill me.
She dicks none.
Jesse Dick's done. I like my heart where it is, and I don't want to go to the market. But this is the film debut of Kate Beckinsale. This is her first theatrical role. And like we said before, you know, she's very young. She's taking a break from college to be here. And then looking at her profile now, she's like almost 50. And it's just like, man, time just moves on.
It's so crazy. Like, because I had to, because she looks so different here than, say, you know, all of like the underworld movies and stuff. And it's just like, yeah, it took me a minute to be like, I know the name. Why does, I can't recognize her. And I had to like look her up on IMDb and I'm like, oh yeah, okay. She just doesn't look like that at all anymore. It's very funny.
Yeah. I mean, 30 years. Yeah. It's been 31 years since she did it. She was literally 18 when this movie came out.
Yeah. It's crazy. Cause it's like with like Emma Thompson, she's essentially her, you know, like she looks essentially the same now, but like with a few more wrinkles, and her hair is white now, and it's just like but like she's
Emma Thompson was also a grown ass woman.
Well, exactly, is film too. Exactly, that's what I'm saying. Like she was at this point, Emma Thompson was a fully established her, and it's just funny.
Yeah, because like I would say Kate Beckinsale looks basically the same over the past 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, like, but yeah, I knew who she was going into this, so I wasn't like, oh, who could this be? But I also didn't really see a whole lot of resemblance between, you know, this person and the Kate Beckinsale who I know. You know, just this is kind of an aside, but you know, being 49. She is past the age that Hollywood tends to tolerate female actors. Mm. But she did recently star in like a streaming movie called Jolt, where she plays like basically an action hero going on like a roaring rampage of revenge, like killing just a bunch of people. And that seems to, like, Hollywood has lately kind of been going like, you know what, we should, like, when women get too old to be hot, this is me quoting them, I'm not, it's not my actual feeling, when they get too old to be hot, we should just have them be action stars. Because that seems to, there's been a trend that kind of pops up, been popping up lately, like the older actresses kind of being more in action hero type roles than anything else.
Yeah,
I feel like this is happening with Charlize Theron.
Yeah, that's exactly the thought I had, that she had, yeah, that's kind of, huh, it is kind of an interesting turn of events.
Yeah, I'm not not really sure. Anyway, I do want to talk about Denzel Washington as Don Pedro, and this is, has to be the least intense I've ever seen a Denzel Washington performance in all my years of watching Denzel Washington movies.
Yeah, he's just like very chill and charming like the whole way.
Yeah, like he's really good in this film, because in it, it's all, his performance is completely carried by his, just his, this dashing charisma that he just kind of exudes here. Something that maybe his son should take some lessons in. I'm not saying his son is bad, just saying he doesn't have that charisma.
What is he in?
Oh, so John David Washington is who I'm referring to. He's been in a lot of things. And by the way, Denzel Washington has a 38-year-old son. So, like, Jesus, like time makes fools of us all. But the most famous thing he was in was Tenet.
Oh,
it just came out a couple.
Okay.
And Black Klansman, which he was also in the star.
Okay. I don't think I realized that he was Denzel Washington's son.
Yeah, he totally is. And he's fine, but he's not his father. Like, the thing about Denzel Washington's performances is that they're usually just so intense. Like, usually, like, the conflict is more dire, the stakes are high, and, you know, even, like, in, even when I guess he's playing like an angel or whatever, like things just seem to be just, you know, just like more intense performances. But here he's just such a, he's just kind of just a go with the flow, charming guy that I like, if this is the first time I'd ever seen him, I would have been completely confused by every other performance I'd see after this. But, like, you know, this is, like, early 90s Denzel, so we're, like, you know, I think this is not too far off from Malcolm X.
Yeah, it, so compare it would hard it would be hard to see this and then Glory.
Yeah. Like, if you're watching a Denzel Washington marathon, don't go from this to Training Day.
Yeah, it, I mean, obviously, contrast this with him and Macbeth, which is
Most I have not seen his Macbeth, but, like, I know, and I actually have never read or seen Macbeth. It's like the big Shakespeare play that I haven't seen. Because I have not seen a lot of them, but that's, like, the probably the biggest one that I haven't seen. Oh, you know what I mean?
I'm sad, like, that you haven't seen a Patrick Stewart's Macbeth. That's a
no. I've seen Hamlet. I've seen Romeo and Juliet, but I have not seen Macbeth, which is, like, is a glaring omission. Oh, also, I haven't seen Othello either, but I think Othello is not quite as prestigious as Macbeth is in pop culture. But those two are the big ones I haven't seen or read.
Oh, I actually had to read Othello, I want to say, sophomore year of high school.
Yeah, we read a different Shakespeare play every year of my time in high school, but just not those.
Hmm. All right.
I was the other AP English class apparently did Macbeth, and then my class did Hamlet.
Mm. Oh, my AP English class, we did King Lear.
I can't remember if I did King Lear in high school, and I think I may have done that in college.
I just remember, because this is Ms. Davison's class that I had that AP English. I just remember us yelling in class, "Stand up for bastards." Good times.
Okay, anyway, Denzel Washington is solid in here. He's very charming. I feel kind, like, if he wasn't just a jerk ass, it turns out, the character, like, throughout the back half of the film, I would have actually considered him one of my favorite characters, because he is very gracious in being rejected.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe something can happen between us. So, no, I don't think that's going to work. It's like, that's fair enough. Let's be friends.
Yeah. I'm happy that he does a good job. Like, I'm happy that at least, like, when people talk about this movie, he's not the one that everyone's like, oh, what a horrible performance. Just, like, as the one black person there, you know, it's just like, we need the black person to be good. And, like, I'm happy that he does a good job and holds his own.
Denzel Washington here is actually probably stunt casting. Because I've heard the term colorblind. Yeah, I've heard the term colorblind casting associated with this film. I don't think this film has colorblind casting. I think this film just wanted Denzel Washington in it.
Yeah, you can, like, that is, someone saying that is absolute white shit. You can't say that it's quote-unquote colorblind casting when you have one person of color and everyone else is white. Like, that's not, you just wanted Denzel Washington, for sure.
I'm pretty sure at this point he's the biggest star in this, with Keanu Reeves. I can't remember if this is before or after Speed. If this is before Speed, then Keanu Reeves would be number two. If it's after Speed, then Keanu Reeves might be tied for one. Let's look it up.
When did Speed come out?
I want to say 93.
Oh, 1994.
1994. Okay, yeah. So Keanu Reeves is, like, probably number two or three,
but depending on... But we have had Point Break.
We've had Point Break. We've had Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Yeah.
Keanu Reeves has not become the biggest movie star in the world until The Matrix comes out.
Yeah.
And then he becomes the biggest movie star... He becomes the biggest action star in the world when John Wick comes out, like, 20 years after that. Hey, let's go ahead and just skip ahead to Keanu Reeves. Let's talk about him, because this is kind of related to what I wanted to say about Don Pedro when it comes to stunt casting. Now, I get that, you know, you may not be able to tell who somebody's dad or who their mother is, but I find it very hard to believe that Denzel Washington as Don Pedro is the half-brother of Keanu Reeves as Don John.
Oh, yeah, sure. And this is why, and as a black person who wants to be able to play whoever the fuck I want without worrying about someone being like, but you're the sister of Perpetua or whatever. I think it helps. That kind of thing helps when you actually make a diverse cast. So you don't have to have as much of that, like, well, this is obviously not a thing. You know, going back to the Brandy Cinderella, which I always say. Fighters and Hammers, Cinderella. Brandy Cinderella.
Brandy Cinderella. Oh, there was some sort of reunion special of that just super recently that I missed. Did you happen to catch that?
I can't remember if I was planning.
It was literally like earlier this year.
Yeah, it was like some like interviews though, right? Like, yeah. I feel like I think I saw some of it, but like that's a prime example of like the cast itself is just, we are just casting whoever, and it just is, and you just accept it, and I think that's perfectly fun. Yeah, if you're gonna have like a fully white cast and then decide you want this famous black person in it, and then you have like a kind of like, well, those two aren't half brothers, like, and mind you, Keanu Reeves is not fully white, so there is actually technically two people of color in the movie. My apologies.
I know what you're trying to say there, but I guarantee you, nobody in Hollywood viewed him as anything other than a white guy when they
were
making the cast here.
I 100% think that Hollywood essentially views him as white, but I also want to acknowledge people who are people of color who just look white and feel bad when their ethnicity is not acknowledged. So just throwing that out there.
Anyway, let's actually talk about Keanu Reeves' performance here, because kind of getting off track there. So I just want to say that I was not offended by Keanu Reeves' performance here. I thought he's not necessarily the actor you want to put into Shakespeare because of the type of dialogue and then like the monologues that can come from there. But I didn't hear him talk and be like, oh God, what a terrible performance. I was just going like, this is a bad casting choice. He's probably going to get somebody else.
Yeah. I would say that, like, I remember being much more critical when I first saw this movie years and years ago. It's like, oh, and this was, which was also like, girl, you hardly know Shakespeare yourself. Like, why are you being so critical? But I just remember like, oh God, he's just so bad. He sticks out like a sore thumb, blah, blah, blah. And like now, yeah, I'm like, yeah, he's pretty wooden. Clearly Shakespeare is not his thing, but it's not awful. Like, I think he just doesn't know what to do with the language because he's not that comfortable with it.
Yeah, I mean, like, this is something I have to kind of remind non-actors about a lot, in that acting for the stage and acting for the screen are very, very, very different. And those worlds blend a little bit with Shakespeare, because like the way that you would perform a Shakespeare script on stage is going to be very different from the way you would do it on screen. But like when it comes down to it, like it's still clearly a script, like a play like for the stage. So having an actor who is, he's not a guy you're going to see on Broadway. He's not a Broadway guy.
Yeah, and like, I mean, there are many different kinds of actors, and not every actor knows how to like use language as a weapon and as a tool like that. I mean, considering the movies that he had done before this, the language isn't complex. Like, it's, and he doesn't necessarily have to go far out of his comfort zone as far as like the type of characters that he's portraying. And so like, I think he just,
yeah, in general, there's probably just a lot less memorization, like all across the board.
Yeah, probably
like
not.
In a movie. So like, you know, it's just different. Like, it's just not, he's just not the guy to do it. I think there's a couple of people in this film who are not the guy to do it.
Yeah. I would say like looking back at this, I feel like Keanu Reeves is more like, he's like the guy in the theater department who is very quick to be cast in lead roles because he is fit and attractive. And
oh, very, very attractive.
Yeah. And like, and so he's quick to get cast in like the lead of every show, whether he fits it or not. And that could lead to a performance that could have definitely been done better by someone else. and you want to get mad about it, but he's also like genuinely nice, and you're like, well, you're not, it's like, I can't get that mad at you. You're not a dick. You're just existing. And so like, I feel like I'm more in that spot now. And then you get older and you know, you're like, ah, I remember that time when they freaking cast you in Don John. Boy, what a time.
I think Reeves is just the type of guy that you have stay in his lane. And he stays in his lane. He's really good.
So yeah, like, you know, we love like the John
Matrix,
Wick.
Yeah, the Matrix movies, the John Wick movies. I literally can't picture anyone else in those roles. But then, you know, you cast him in Bram Stoker's Dracula and come to an English accent, and he's shit.
So. I forgot about that. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, I think that's kind of like why I'm like, he's fine here.
Because
I remember Bram Stoker's Dracula, which he's considerably worse, probably because like it's him reciting Shakespeare's lines are already like they're already kind of ridiculous to begin with. So like your suspension of disbelief is like a little lower. But then you watch him when he's actually speaking like, you know, modern English and a shitty accent.
Oh.
And wooden. Like, no, it's just not. It doesn't work. All right.
Speaking of shitty accents, can we talk a little bit about Michael Keaton?
Yes, the dark horse here, or the dog horse, if you will. when I said who's the most famous person in here, like Michael Keaton, I think he's on his way down by 93. You know, I think he's like, he's coming down. Like, we're a few years out from, I take that back, because Batman Returns would have just come out the year before.
Yeah.
I think the 90s was kind of like Michael Keaton's downslope in general.
His dip, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why they cast Michael Keaton in this. Like for a couple of reasons. Like, ignoring the performance, like, why would you cast someone like Michael Keaton in such a kind of like lower level role like this?
Yeah.
Role that if you really wanted to like cut for time, you could probably cut out this and all the scenes with him. And it wouldn't affect too much. You just have to, like, have a lot more, like, oh, this happened off screen. And it probably wouldn't have affected that much. That happens in Shakespeare all the time.
Yeah. I mean, that happens, essentially,
Yeah,
like, this, it literally happens in this movie for Don John's capture. So, you know, whatever. It's always like what person was like, you know, Michael Keaton can do comedy. I'm just throwing it out there.
Yeah, because that's where he comes from. Like, it was like the idea of him doing Batman was controversial because he was a comedic actor.
It's like, let's not forget. But oh
yeah, did anybody here say Beetlejuice? And they all started high fiving each other. Like, this is brilliant casting.
Yeah, I would say that I wrote down my impressions on Michael Keaton's accent. I wrote that he sounds like a pirate drinking Guinness in a library.
Oh boy. Do I hate Michael Keaton's performance in here, or do I hate the concept of the character of Dogberry?
I personally I'm gonna lean more towards disliking Michael Keaton, because I have seen other portrayals of Dogberry and had more fun. At the very least, it was easier to understand what the fuck he was saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I had subtitles, so I could tell what he was saying, but I'm not sure I would have been able to tell what he was saying if they weren't there.
Yeah.
And then at some point, near the end of the film, the subtitles started malfunctioning.
Oh, no.
So it was a little hard to understand what was happening when he started explaining the Don John stuff to Leonardo.
And their weird kind of Monty Python-esque entrances with not really riding horses. Just kind of weird. Like, it just felt very uneven, that whole stuff. Like, it kind of felt like there just wasn't that much thought put into the Dogberry stuff. It's like, I mean, if you're gonna have it. And maybe, you know. Yeah, it's weird.
They probably could have gotten somebody else. Like, speaking of someone who's not a Shakespeare guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Although Michael Keaton hadn't quite gotten to the point in his career where he just said, fuck it, and just kept his New York accent and everything he did. That doesn't really happen until, like, the 2000s. So I don't have much else to say about any other character except for one. If there's someone else you want to bring up, feel free to after this. But I do want to do a shout out to Brian Blessed.
Yeah.
Who back on the podcast. I think the last time we talked about him was Tarzan.
I think so. I think you're right.
Yeah. Brian Blessed is fantastic. Brian Blessed doesn't do much here. Like, I was
it's actually so mad. So disappointing. So, like, rewatching this, I think the first time I fully watched this movie, I did not know who Brian Blessed was. So I didn't know how I was being cheated. But upon watching it this time, I'm like, oh, fuck, Brian Blessed is here. And I couldn't really remember, you know, how much Antonio is in the... Antonio is Leonardo's brother. I couldn't remember how much he's in it. And I just like, he's barely talking. He's very talking. Why? Yeah. And like finally, when Leonardo and Antonio confront Pedro and Claudio, you get some monologue in from him. And he's very, for the little bit he gets, he's very good. I'm just like, God damn it, Kenneth Branagh, you should have changed your choice of play to give more Brian Blessed to this movie. Like, he's like, you should have just decided that you wanted to do a Brian Blessed vehicle.
Ugh. I mean, like, is there any reason why Brian Blessed couldn't be Leonardo?
No reason. Oh.
No reason.
I would have loved him just be like, welcome to my home. You are our guest. And just be like,
oh man, jolly. I would have loved to see him hug Denzel Washington so hard that he lifts him off the ground when he shows when they show up.
Oh my god!
Blessed.
I mean, like, I don't want to just like shit on Richard Briers. He's fine, but I mean, I wouldn't miss him. Let's get Brian Blessed in there.
This is the equivalent of hiring a famous Broadway singer to play a character who sings none of the songs in the musical you're filming, and then hire like some random Hollywood starlet who's like a big name who doesn't sing because they have to hire a different Broadway person to sing her lines. And meanwhile, you have this other Broadway person who's right there.
Yeah. So many times we go through this. I just
use the
talents that you already got. Why is everyone always sleeping on people? Yeah,
it's weird. We're just not watching the right movies on this podcast. Is the problem? we're watching the wrong ones. Anyway, yeah, Blessed doesn't do that much. His main contribution here is he's the father of the fake cousin.
Yeah,
that that's the thing. His character Antonio is not Beatrice's father. I don't know what Beatrice's parentage is looking like.
Yeah, who knows?
He's apparently nobody seems to know anything about Antonio because everyone's like, oh, he has a daughter. Okay, cool. I guess that tracks.
Yeah, it's, you know, Antonio's family in Canada. Sure.
Yeah, he's his daughter at Vancouver from Alberta. No, his daughter Alberta. She comes from Vancouver.
She's his daughter, his favorite daughter. Yeah, more Brian Blessed. I think the only other person I want to shout out is Imelda Staunton, who's, you know, small part. She plays Margaret, gets very much cut down in this. Like, all of her scenes really get just beep. Because, like, Margaret is, like, the third largest female character in this, and she does get more stuff in the... In the actual play. She doesn't really get that here. You can't even get, like, that invested in the fact that, like, she's the one who ends up, like, you know, getting mixed up in the quote-unquote talking out a window stuff. Because she's like, you barely even see her in this. But I want to shout out to her because, one, once again, we're only 1 degree away from each other because we've had the same choreographer for musicals that we've been in. Slash my hair back. And... it also is funny that, I mean, you know, it's British people doing things. So we do have, you know, 3 Harry Potter alums in this. You know, obviously, Emma Thompson is Professor Trelawney, and Kenneth Branagh is Gilderoy Lockhart, and then Imelda Staunton.
I missed all these big name people in in Harry Potter, because I stopped watching it until the second movie, and they hadn't gotten big enough to just attract all these big name British actors yet.
Yeah, they get real big because, you know, Imelda Staunton, she plays Dolores Umbridge, and like she does such an amazing job with that character. She does like the perfect brand of evil that character needs to be. It's great. But like,
yeah, I recently saw her in something. I just saw her in the Downton Abbey movies.
Oh, I didn't know she was in them.
Yeah, I believe she is the relative of the family who had the big estate that she didn't have an heir for, and she's like, oh, I'm gonna give it to my maid, and like Maggie Smith's character was like, what? All right, anything else that we want to talk about the film before we get to our grade here?
The one song, Sigh No More, which is a thing in the play, and you know, one of the fun things about, you know, whatever show decides to do this, whoever decides to do this production, is they get to like, you know, make up a tune for this song. It just said it a lot.
They did.
I just got tired of it. And it is hard because, like, in the beginning, it, like, once again, Kenneth Branagh being just very serious in what he's doing. And it's like, you're having this, like, poetry version of this. And, like, the way it's just like, hey, Nonny, Nonny. Yeah. It's like, okay, I can't with this. Like, you can't.
First minute of the film, you're already tired of
it. Like, that's not good. You could not say, hey, Nonny, Nonny, with that kind of reference. Stop that.
Yes, that's kind of funny. I want to just point out that, Ariel, you're not only are you a trained Shakespearean actor, but you're one of those Shakespearean actors that they have to also play guitar, like, while some of those songs are being played.
That is true. I have done that before.
So you're like a... I mean, like, okay, I say double threat because we're not talking about anything other aside from acting and guitar playing. But, and singing. No, that's a triple threat. You're a triple threat.
Oh.
You can sing, you can act, you can play guitar.
Oh, man, I thought you were going to say it. I can crow, and I was going to cut you off and crow.
And crow. Okay. Okay, so, Ariel, what would you give Much Ado About Nothing? Would you give it a thumbs up, a thumbs down, or a thumbs somewhere in the middle?
I am going to give it a solid middle. It is not, like I said, it's not like my, it's kind of hard. I think as far as like Shakespeare movies go, it's probably more of a thumbs up because it is fun. The way, this is like the slot that I think I have this movie in. Summer afternoon with some like light summer drink, and you're just having a good time. I think it fits well into that slot. I don't like love it, but like I love me some Emma Thompson, and like it is a very pretty movie. And so like I think it rocks the Sunday afternoon, maybe with a Rattler or something cute. And you just enjoy the aesthetic of it.
I'm going to give it a thumbs in the middle as well. And only because I hate Claudio so much. Like, the whole thing about them turning on Hero so much and how the movie gets real sexist real quickly.
Yeah.
And this is Shakespeare, obviously. This movie didn't make it that way. They're just doing what Shakespeare did. And I don't think people were too worried about being sexist when this was being written. But it just kind of hurt the film a lot for me. I was enjoying it a lot outside of that. Like, it was just a fun movie. I would have given it a thumbs up just for being very enjoyable. But it kind of killed my enjoyment enough where I put it more like a, you know, thumbs in the middle. Good time, but I don't know if I will need to watch it again anytime soon.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of dreading. It's like, oh, man, do I have to watch this again? Because we didn't record immediately.
Sure.
It's like, it also would cost me $4 to do it.
So. Yeah, I'm so sorry, but I got sick last week, but I'm back. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So I have no idea what we're doing next time because I don't know when this is coming up.
Yeah.
I don't even know if, like you said, we were in the middle of the Disney stuff. I haven't even, as of this recording, I haven't even put up Waterboy yet.
Oh.
So.
Huh.
So, this might go up before any of those Disney movies get put up. So,
well, in this case, I'll chase the intro. I know that you all have just seen Waterboy, and now we're switching gears quite a bit to some Shakespeare. All right, you can just put that at the front.
Yeah, I'm not going to do it. But if this goes up after Waterboy, then the next movie, I believe, is Emperor's New Groove. Mm. So, but I'm not going to repeat any jokes we may have made in Waterboy for that. But I will, you know, this is one last thing about What to Do About Nothing. I want to watch Twelfth Night. That's all I'm going to say. Well, I like Twelfth Night.
Sure.
Yeah. I like Julius Caesar, too.
Julius Caesar can be a very fun time, I think.
I like Titus Andronicus, but I've been led to believe that Titus Andronicus is one of Shakespeare's more embarrassing plays. Mm.
The last time I saw Titus Andronicus, I got free food out of it, even though it technically was supposed to represent eating humans. But it was really good. It was like freaking like dumplings. It was great.
It's great. That's good human.
Yeah, that is. Your sons are delicious.
Oh my goodness, this is great. That is a very violent play. If you guys want to get a hold of us, email us at adultsiblingsversus@gmail.com, tweet at us on Twitter @adultversus, and you can contact us on Facebook. Our theme song is Sell Out by Zombie Apocalypse Now from the EP Forbidden Tales of Science. You can find that and more at antizombie.bandcamp.com. I hope that's right, because I don't have it in front of me. I'm going to ask you a serious question, Ariel. Mm-hmm. What would you say is your favorite Shakespeare play? Not just like, the easiest one to read, or the most fun to read, but what is your favorite Shakespeare play?
That's a good question. I don't mean to like piggyback off of you, but I think it might be Twelfth Night. I just feel like I have the most fun with Twelfth Night, not just as a read, but just like, I think I just enjoy that show the most. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, in any case, we're going to see if there's any local performances of Twelfth Night that are a little loose about the audience participation. But until next time, as always, please do not put a dirty sock in your younger sibling's mouth.
I love you, Morgan. I'll miss you always.